Hello, this is Ideas and Issues, and I'm your host, Hugh Follett. My guest this week is Jared Diamond, professor of physiology at the UCLA Medical School, and we're going to be discussing his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Professor Diamond, glad to have you on the show.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
In the beginning of your book, you describe the book as an attempt to answer the question, why are wealth and power distributed in the world the way they are? Or put differently, why did development proceed at different rates on different continents? Could you briefly explain your answer?
Sure. The question would be, here I am in California looking out my window, and I'm of European ancestry, and yet I'm sitting on land that was occupied by Native Americans 500 years ago. So why is it that Europeans were the people to spread over the world rather than Native Americans or Aboriginal Australians or Africans? The immediate reasons are obvious to all of us. They're what gave my book its title, Guns, Germs, and Steel. It was Eurasian societies that came up first with guns, germs, and steel, riding, political power, empires, and so on, the things that let them go out and conquer other peoples. But the real question is, why did guns, germs, and steel, and riding and metal tools, develop first in Eurasia rather than in Aboriginal Australia or the New World or Sub-Saharan Africa? And so that's the main question that my book is concerned with, that question of ultimate cause. The ultimate causes turn out to be environmental. It's not that Eurasian people were smarter or luckier or anything else compared to other peoples. It's that there were environmental reasons, particularly concerned with the prerequisites for the origin of farming that gave Eurasia the head start.
All right, I wonder if you could give a slightly more expanded version of that argument now, and then we can look at the elements in detail. I mean, you say that guns, germs, and steel are, in your language, the proximate causes for the success of Eurasians. What's the explanation for the fact that Eurasians, and not North Americans at least initially, had guns, germs, and steel?
The easiest of those things to figure out is germs. Molecular biological studies of the last 20 years have answered the question, why is it that the really nasty infectious diseases like smallpox and measles and tuberculosis and flu, why did almost all of those diseases arise in Eurasia so that Native Americans had no immunity to them and were wiped out by them? Why is it not the case that nasty infectious diseases instead arose in the New World to infect Europeans? And the answer from molecular biology is that these nasty germs of humans evolved over the course of the last 10,000 years from nasty germs of our domestic animals with which we began to come into close contact when we started domesticating cow, sheep, and goat 10,000 years ago. But domestic animals were domesticated overwhelmingly in Eurasia and very few in the New World. In fact, the only big mammal domesticated in the New World was the llama, whereas there were 13 species in Eurasia. So that's a simple reason why there were far more nasty germs in Eurasia than in the New World. The argument is somewhat more involved to understand why writing and empires and steel evolved in Eurasia than the New World. But basically it's similar. It's that all these ingredients of power depended upon the origin of farming and herding societies. It's only farmers and herders who develop writing and empires and metal tools. But Eurasia had not just far more mammals that could be domesticated, it also had far more plants. And the result is that farming and then herding arose first in Eurasia, and from farming and herding, then a few thousand years later arose metal tools, and then eventually writing, empires, guns, and steel.
Okay, that's a very nice synopsis. Let's look at each of those in a bit more detail. The point about germs, maybe you could elaborate a little bit more about exactly why, I mean, once they've been developed, exactly why germs like smallpox and so on were not as detrimental in Eurasia, or didn't seem to be as detrimental in Eurasia, as they were in the New World.
Yes, that is a paradox. When one first says smallpox arose in Eurasia, one's first reaction is, my God, that's really bad news for Eurasians. Weren't Native Americans lucky that smallpox didn't arise in the New World? The explanation of that paradox is as follows. if you are exposed to smallpox as a child rather than as an adult, your chances of surviving these epidemic infectious diseases like smallpox and measles are higher if you are exposed as a child than as an adult. And once you have your bout of smallpox and measles or measles and survive it, you then develop antibodies that make you immune for the rest of your life, so you're not going to get sick with it again as an adult. In Eurasia, where these diseases were endemic, that's to say they were there all the time, everybody got exposed to smallpox, measles, TB, flu, etc. as a child and developed immunity, and yes, 20 or 30% of the population died, but the other 70 or 80% survived. In the New World, Native Americans had the misfortune to be exposed to smallpox and measles brought by Europeans, and they were exposed to these diseases as adults. The death rates were much higher. In addition, 10,000 years of exposure to smallpox and measles gave Europeans and Asians some genetic immunity to these diseases. So those are the two reasons: the buildup of antibodies if you are exposed and survive as a child, and the development of genetic resistance. That's why Eurasians paradoxically developed some resistance to smallpox, whereas a dramatic example is that when tuberculosis first arrived in Saskatchewan and Manitoba in Canada in the 1880s, Native Americans were dying at the rate of 10% per year, and within a decade, most of the Native American population of that province was gone.
That explains, I think, why the Eurasians had, if you will, nastier germs than North Americans. Now the next question, though, is exactly how did this help Eurasians conquer the New World?
It helped Eurasians conquer the New World because the great majority of Native Americans, we think of wars and battles between Native Americans and Europeans, and yes, there were some spectacular battles in North America and in the conquest of the Aztec Empire, but the cruel fact is that something like 95% of Native Americans died in bed of European germs, leaving 5% to fight it out on the battlefield with Europeans. So that, in fact, by far the biggest advantage that Europeans had in the conquest of the New World was their germs. In particular, for example, in Cortez's conquest of the Aztec Empire, on Cortez's first attack against the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, Cortez and his troop were thrown out of Mexico City and thrown back to the coast, and it looks as if they were about to get thrown into the ocean. But at that point, they landed on the coast of Mexico a slave from Cuba who had smallpox. Smallpox spread to the Aztecs. Within a few months, something like half of the population of the Aztec Empire was dead, including the Aztec emperor. The Aztecs not only lost half of their people and their emperor, but they ended up thoroughly demoralized by this mysterious disease that killed Indians and seemed to kill very few Spaniards. And then Cortez came back on a second attack and conquered the Aztecs. Same thing happened with the conquest of the Inca Empire. Smallpox came first, killed off about half the Incas, including the emperor and his designated heir, and the result was a civil war that Pizarro exploited.
Okay, now this leads us back to a somewhat different, though related question. I mean, you said earlier that one of the reasons Eurasians had these germs is that we borrowed them, if you will, from domesticated animals. And you'd also said earlier that one of the reasons that we have this advantage in military power and in technology was that Eurasia first developed farming in a way that it was not developed elsewhere in the world. So there's some sort of connection between the cause of these nasty germs and the cause of our technological superiority. Let's just take a specific example. I mean, we have all heard about the Fertile Crescent, and you talk about the way in which food production really began in the Fertile Crescent. Perhaps one way of putting the question is this: why did it begin there rather than in the United States?
Good question. Why did agriculture begin in the Fertile Crescent rather than the United States? And today, that's really an acute question because the United States has the most productive agriculture in the world. Here I am sitting in California, the breadbasket of the United States, and yet agriculture never arose independently in California. Instead, the first agriculture in the world arose in that place called the Fertile Crescent, which is a crescent-shaped band of land running through parts of modern Iran, Iraq, Syria, southeastern Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. And when I say the Fertile Crescent, at first, that sounds like a bad joke. Are you kidding that Iraq is the Fertile Crescent, one of the most infertile places in the world today? But the lands of the Fertile Crescent got a head start on agriculture because they were an area, because of climate and they're being embedded in the large Eurasian continent, that had the largest number of wild plant and animal species suitable for domestication. And in particular, in the area in and near the Fertile Crescent, there lived the wild ancestors of wild barley, all three of the wild wheats, peas, lentils, chickpeas, flax, and then the most valuable animals in the world, wild cows, sheep, goats, pigs, and nearby horses. So by the luck of biogeography where they were living, the people of the Fertile Crescent inherited the most valuable domesticable wild plants and animals in the world. They were the first people around 8500 BC to settle down and become farmers and herders. They were the first people to undergo the population explosion associated with farming, to develop the food surpluses that could be used to feed smiths and then scribes and emperors and priests, and that gave them about a 5,000-year head start over people of the New World, who eventually domesticated corn and many other plants, but had far fewer animals to domesticate.
All right, so a key part of the story is with societies that are engaged in plant production and have domestic animals, that they become stable, they become tied to a particular geographical area. When tied to that particular geographical area, the population is going to become larger because it can support a larger population, and then that's going to allow for certain sorts of specialization and also trade, which you talk about.
That's right. I would say the two things, particularly about agriculture, that gave the first farmers a huge head start were that, first of all, as you say, agriculture produced a population explosion. There's in a wheat field, everything is edible, whereas looking out my window at this forest here, most of the plants that I see here are not edible. So there's just a far greater density of food in a pasture or garden than there is in a forest, and the result is that population densities of farmers are typically about 1,000 times the population densities of hunter-gatherers. There are just many more farmers. The other advantage of the agricultural lifestyle is that it produces food surpluses that can be stored, such as wheat that can be brought home and stored, or dairy products or meat that can be dried out. And those stored food surpluses can be used to feed people who sit in the village, not go out and farm at all, but devote all their time to figuring out how to smelt copper or how to design riding systems or to be kings. So that's why the fact is that throughout history, the mastery of metal arose only in farming societies, the development of writing arose only in farming societies, and the development of complex political organization, kings and political leaders beyond the level of chiefs, arose only in farming societies.
Okay, so what happened in these societies is that by having this concentration of people, you have specialization. Some of the people who can specialize as soldiers, which ended up giving these areas both a defensive advantage as well as an offensive advantage. But perhaps more than that, it allowed them to develop technology, writing, and, as you said, complex political organizations. And again, specifically, you also talk about the importance of trade, that once you had this number of people located in a certain area, then they wanted to expand their influence as well as expand the areas in which they drew the products that they used. And this encouraged trade between areas.
That's correct. All humans trade, not just farmers, but hunter-gatherers. I spent a lot of the last 40 years working on the island of New Guinea, the tropical island of New Guinea, where some people, even in modern times, were hunter-gatherers, and hunter-gatherers trade with each other and just as do farmers. The striking thing, and this was perhaps the most dramatic eureka moment of working on my book, is that there are differences among the continents in the ease of trade. In particular, the Eurasian continent, let's just all picture a globe and a map. Eurasia is long from east to west and narrow from north to south. And again, just picture the map, picture the Americas, long from north to south, narrow from east to west. Africa, long from north to south, narrow from east to west. But it's much easier to exchange crops and livestock east-west, because the wheat and the sheep and the cattle can move east-west always at the same latitude, day length, similar diseases, similar habitats. And the result is that there was rapid exchange of crops and livestock and the technology and culture associated with them in Eurasia, but not in the New World or in Africa. So that pretty soon the Chinese were eating wheat and barley, domesticating the Fertile Crescent, and the Romans were chomping on Chinese peaches and oranges. Whereas in the New World, the llama domesticated in the Andes never got to Mexico, and the sunflower from the southeastern United States never got to the Andes. So in short, trade within Eurasia produced an enrichment of the whole continent, but that was much less the case in Africa and the New World because of their north-south orientation.
And that would explain, too, then why, for instance, agriculture didn't develop in Australia in the way that we think about it until fairly recently.
In the case of Australia, agriculture didn't develop there because there was practically nothing that could be domesticated. Australia, first of all, is the smallest continent, has many fewer species of wild plants and animals than does Eurasia or Africa or the Americas. And then secondly, most of the big mammals of Australia went extinct or were exterminated when the ancestors of Aboriginal Australians arrived about 40,000 years ago, so that the only big mammals left in Australia were the two species of big kangaroos, the great red and the great gray kangaroo, but they can't be herded. They're not herd animals the way sheep and cattle and goats are. And the result is that today, Australian farmers, they're not growing kangaroos, they're growing cows and sheep that were brought in from the Fertile Crescent. And then as far as plants are concerned, Australian plants, the only native Australian plant that has been domesticated is the macadamia nut. But you can feed a civilization from wheat and barley and peas and lentils, but you can't feed a civilization from macadamia nuts alone. So that's why Aboriginal Australians, not a single one of those 250 tribes, ever ended up as farmers.
Okay, so that would explain why they didn't develop it on their own, and presumably the reason they didn't develop it or receive it through trade was simply that there wasn't the north-south trade that would permit their picking up and adopting the agriculture of the Fertile Crescent.
That's correct. The two opportunities for Aboriginal Australians to have acquired crops would have been from the New Guinea highlands to the north of Australia, where sugarcane and yams and some other things were domesticated, or from Indonesia, into which arrived Chinese crops and tropical Asian crops, including taro. But for those crops to spread into Australia would have meant getting established in northern Australia, which is desert. And because of the north-south axis of Australia and the difficulties of trade with New Guinea and Southeast Asia, crops never came into Australia from the outside until Europeans arrived on ships.
Now let's go back to one other thing that you talked about. I mean, you talked about the emergence of centralized governments and the role that that played and the way in which that was tied up with the emergence of technology. Is it the case that any time you had a country in which agriculture had been developed for a sufficiently long period of time, that eventually that country did develop a centralized government, that eventually that country did develop certain sorts of technology?
Almost. There are nine places in the world where agriculture developed independently, and in most of those, societies developed to the point of centralized government. That was not the case in New Guinea, the highlands of New Guinea, one of the nine centers of agriculture. New Guineans never got beyond the levels of tribes. They did not even get to the point in the highlands of chiefdoms. And the reason is that New Guinea agriculture was the least well-endowed agriculture in the world, with no native domestic animals and only a handful of domestic plants. Otherwise, in the New World, agriculture rose in three places: the Andes, Mexico, and the southeastern United States, all developed chiefdoms, and the Andes and Mexico developed empires. In Eurasia, the Fertile Crescent developed empires. In Africa, the three centers of agriculture, Ethiopia, tropical West Africa, and the Sahel zone, eventually developed chiefdoms, and rather late, empires arose or states arose in tropical West Africa and Ethiopia, though not really in the Sahel. So that's a long-winded way of saying that what you say about the relation between agriculture and empires is almost true.
Okay, so you had to have the agriculture in order to have the empires, and that almost always, if you had the agriculture, you would get the empires.
Perfect, yeah.
Okay. Now, that actually leads to the next question. I mean, one of the concerns or objections which some people have raised to your account, that your account is deterministic, that it makes all human history depend upon biological diversity and the environment. Is that a fair charge?
Well, deterministic is one of those words that makes many people, especially historians, shut down and stop thinking clearly. What deterministic means simply is that geographic environmental factors have a big influence on human affairs, and anybody would have to be silly to deny that. For example, today, landlocked countries that don't have access to a seacoast or rivers are at a disadvantage as regards transportation. And desert countries or the Arctic, nobody expected the Inuit to become masters of the world, nor did anyone expect the Aborigines of the Central Australian Desert to become masters of the world because of obvious disadvantages of the environment. Even any historian will recognize that. The advantages of Eurasia over the New World were not as lopsided, but they were still big. Three times more plant, more cereal species, three times more big mammal species in Eurasia than in the New World, the east-west axis versus the north-south axis. So yes, there were those strong environmental factors that produced the result. Or to put it this way, it's not the case that there was nothing that any individual Aboriginal Australian or Inuit or Native American could have done to reverse the broad course of human history, because the biogeographic advantages of Eurasia gave Eurasians a 5,000-year head start. If you want to call that determinism, okay. I would simply say that's common sense understanding of geography.
Okay, so you're not wanting to deny that human choices and initiative matter. You're simply wanting to say that that's not the basic explanation for this, what you call the broad course of human history.
I would even reverse that and say that everything, the reason that you and I are now speaking through modern media, has to do with human ingenuity, invention, and intelligence, that all these things got invented. What is the case is that the conditions that permitted feeding the technological specialists, the conditions for human invention, were more favorable in some places than in others. So many of my New Guinea friends are really smart, and nowadays they're flying jet planes and operating computers, which are beyond me. But computers and jet planes didn't arise in New Guinea, despite New Guineans being such intelligent people. And that's because of the environment.
And the problem then with the standard accounts of human history is that they do ignore what you take to be these very important factors that at least set the boundaries on human initiative.
That's correct. The standard accounts of human history, for the most part, avoid this question, the biggest question of history, about why Eurasians rather than Aboriginal Australians or Native Americans or Africans. The question simply isn't discussed because most historians focus on short-term, small-scale history, late 18th century Dutch history or 17th century French history, and they've learned to avoid these big questions. They've learned to avoid them for two reasons. One is that the answers to these big questions depend upon many technical facts of biology and linguistics and archaeology and things that historians aren't trained in. So, for example, to understand the rise of agriculture, you have to understand that the genes controlling bitterness in oak trees are polygenic and the genes controlling bitterness in almonds are a single recessive gene, but that's not something that historians are trained in. And the other reason is that the comparative method that is widespread in sciences like evolutionary biology and astronomy, that's a method widespread in sciences but not in history, which comes from the humanistic tradition. So it's not that historians have attempted to answer the question, come up with another answer. For the most part, historians don't pose this biggest question of history at all.
Well, in the last 4 minutes of the interview, let's talk a little bit about the implications of this. I mean, you say that once we understand the importance of these environmental factors, we get a better understanding of why we have Eurasians have what they have, while other people may not. What sort of lesson do we draw from that fact?
Lesson number one is that most people, if you ask them why Europeans conquer the New World and enslaved Africans. Most people will say, I hate to say this, but it's that Europeans are smarter than all those other people. That's to say, most people have racist explanations. And why? Because historians haven't told them what is the correct explanation for the most obvious result of history. So I'd say the most important policy consequence of my book is to undermine the intellectual basis for racist explanations of history. The other thing is that even in the modern world today, although we've got the internet and phones, it's not the case that the environment is irrelevant. There are still big environmental differences among different parts of the world, and there's the heavy hand of history, the fact that some parts of the world got agriculture and metal tools 10,000 years before other parts. So the major reason, in fact, why some countries today are rich and some countries are poor is not economic differences, as economists like to say. It's not different ways in which investment is organized, but it's these long-term effects of history and differences in the environment that produce different public health problems and different agricultural productivities. So the other main message, besides the anti-racist message, is the environment is still very important today, and you've got to address environmental problems if you want to make poor countries rich.
Okay, and let me see if this is correct, though. It's not that you want to say that economic considerations are irrelevant. It's part of what you want to say is if you want to understand why some countries have the economic advantages or disadvantages they have, you have to look at their environment.
Exactly. Economic and organizational considerations are not irrelevant. Just look at the differences between South and North Korea or between the former East and West Germany. There in the same area, how the society was organized had a big difference. But it's not enough to focus on organization and economics. You got to look at the underlying resource base, which turns out, and there are some recent analyses by economists themselves, turns out that environmental factors are the largest factors explaining the different distribution of wealth and power in the modern world. And then after that come the organizational economic investment things that economists focus on.
Okay, in the last minute and a half, could you sum up and identify what you would see as the most important policy implication, if there are any, for us today?
Sure. Most important policy implications today are that one should not write off any people as stupid or incapable just because they entered the modern world as hunter-gatherers. Instead, the ingredients of power and wealth are transferable. The ingredients of power and wealth are wheat and domestic animals and the knowledge that came out of them. And you pass those to a people so a people who were poor can become rich. Again, my New Guinea friends who grew up using stone tools, they're now flying jet airplanes. So policy implications are that power is transferable, and those particular countries that address their environmental problems, notably Taiwan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, and Mauritius, by recognizing what one's environmental problems are and targeting them, those countries within 30, 40 years became rich. Those are dramatic policy implications.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your appearing in the show today.
You are welcome.
I've been speaking today with Jared Diamond, professor of physiology at the UCLA Medical School, and we've been discussing his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is now available in paperback. This is Eula Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.